Chapter 4. Monday. Shrink to fit.
The somewhat bizarre nature of Spec Ops work and the high level of stress-related retirements led Spec Ops management to undertake a top-down psychological overhaul as early as 1952, when a stringent psychological appraisal of all personnel revealed that few, if any, were completely free of work-related mental issues. Before the entire service was retired, it was discovered that a control sample of ordinary citizens were probably just as mad as those in Spec Ops, and that the ordinary classification was simply set unrealistically high. Once that had been adjusted accordingly, the matter was resolved to the satisfaction of everyone.
Dr. Franz Egg. The effect of Spec Ops work on the human psyche, its possible ramifications to a healthy life, and comments upon needlessly long titles to academic reports.
Dr. Chumley was turned away from me when I entered, and seemed to be leaning on the filing cabinet for support, while his back moved in that way it does when people are silently sobbing.
"Are you okay?" I asked.
"Never better," he replied, his voice with a forced quietness, like when someone steps on your toe with a baby asleep nearby.
"Are you here to talk about issues regarding your work as a serving Spec Ops officer?"
"No," I replied. "I'm here for a psychiatric evaluation at Commander Braxton Hicks's behest."
"Thank God for that," he said, with obvious relief. "I thought I'd have to listen to the crazy antics of some deranged operative who should have been straitjacketed long ago."
He paused for a second.
"I just said that out loud, didn't I?"
"I'm afraid so."
"Damn. I'm Dr. Newton Chumley, by the way."
"Detective Thursday next," I said, shaking his hand. He placed a file in the cabinet, then took out a manila folder. It was big, and Dr. Chumley heaved it to the desk with a thump. He was a young man, probably recently graduated, but the work was already having an effect. His eyes were red, and he had a noticeable tremor.
"You have no idea what I have to go through," he said, offering me a seat before sitting himself. "It's intolerable, I tell you, intolerable."
He rested his face in his hands.
"Early this morning," he said quietly through his fingers, "I had someone who had killed a zombie with a sharpened spade."
"That would be Spike," I replied brightly, having joined him on a few of these expeditions myself.
"And doesn't anything about that seem remotely unusual to you?"
I reflected for a moment.
"Not really. Wait.
Yes?
Spike usually favours a semi-auto 12-gauge. He must have been out of cartridges and used whatever was at hand. It's one of his many talents, adaptability."
"Very laudable," murmured Dr. Chumley, lapsing once more into quiet despondency.
"Actually," I added in order to fill the silence, "technically speaking, zombies are already dead, so you can't kill them. Just disable the diseased part of the cortex that gives them locomotion, and an insatiable thirst for human flesh."
"I so didn't want to know that," said Chumley, staring at me, "and will now have to do my very best to forget it. But I have a feeling the thought will remain and fester in my subconscious until it bubbles to the surface as a full-fledged neurosis, a dozen years from now, when I begin to have an inexplicable aversion to buttons and hedgehogs."
He took a deep breath, calmed himself, and then opened the bulging file, which I noted had my name on the cover. I'd forgotten how much stuff I'd done.
He indicated the closed door.
"Do you know Officer Stiggins?"
"Yes, very well."
"He uses we when he means I. Is that an affectation?"
"Neanderthals are hardwired Marxists," I told him, "and have no concept of the first-person singular pronoun. He would die tomorrow without fear or worry if he felt it would better serve his community."
"Are you saying Karl Marx was a Neanderthal?"
"He was exceptionally hairy," I said reflectively. "But no, I don't think so."
"You know what's really strange?"
"You could once buy lion cubs at Harrods," I replied helpfully. "That's pretty strange."
"Not as strange as this. Of everyone I've interviewed, Officer Stiggins is the most normal. Sensible, thoughtful, and utterly without ego. That's strange,
given that he's the only one who's not human. "Have you met Officer Simpkin?" I asked.
"Yes, charming lady."
"She's not human." He frowned.
"What is she, then?"
"Perhaps it's better you don't know," I replied, considering Chumley's delicate mental state.
"In that you are correct, and I thank you for it."
He looked at my file for a moment, read the good conduct report and then the summary. He stopped after a minute or two and grimaced.
"Did you really kill Acheron Hades with a silver mullet?"
"I think you'll find it says bullet."
"Oh, yes," he said, peering closer. "That makes a lot more sense."
"Acheron's sister wasn't best pleased that I did," I said. "In fact..."
"Can I stop you there?" said Chumley abruptly. "I'd be happier not knowing who Acheron's sister is. My job is to give Commander Hicks an appraisal of your psychological well-being. Now, do you have any delusions, hallucinations, unresolved and deep-seated personal issues, inexplicable phobias, or any other related aberrations that might negatively affect your working efficiency?"
"I don't think so."
"Thank heavens," he said with a contented sigh as he produced a small book of certificates. "I'm going to mark you Nut 1 on the internationally recognized but tactlessly named scale of psychological normality. Disgustingly healthy and level-headed. There, that was easy. I can have a break until my 12 o'clock. She had to kill a man with her thumb, and now can't tie her shoelaces or change her mind without losing her temper. Well, nice meeting you. Close the door on your way out. Cheerio."
But I didn't get up. No one I knew in Spec Ops had been given a clear bill of mental health for decades. In fact, it struck me now that it was possibly a disadvantage. After all, who would ever do the stuff we did without being a little nuts? Victor Analogy had run SO-27 for 26 years and was never ranked higher than a Nut 4, prone to strange and sustained delusional outbursts, but otherwise normal in all respects. I had respected Analogy a great deal, but even I felt slightly ill at ease when he confided in me with all seriousness that he was pregnant with an elephant, foisted on him by an over-amorous server at Arby's. "Actually," I began, "I think someone might be trying to kill me." Chumley stopped what he was doing and stared at me over the top of his spectacles.
"Oh, no," he said. "I'm not falling for that. First you say you're fine, then you say you're not. We call it Hamlet syndrome, an attempt to get your own way by feigning insanity, generally by saying what comes into your head and talking a lot. Mind you," he added thoughtfully, "works a lot better if you're a prince."
"I'm not kidding," I replied. "Goliath is out to cause me harm." I stared at him earnestly, and he narrowed his eyes. It was true, too. The Goliath Corporation and I had not seen eye to eye over the past 2 decades. They no longer controlled Spec Ops, but had run the police force ever since the entire service had been privatized.
"In my experience, that's hardly evidence of delusion," he said. "Goliath is out to get lots of people. Being wary of multinationals shouldn't be paranoia, but more a case of standard operating procedure."
Goliath wasn't universally loved, but since it employed almost a fifth of England's workforce, no one was keen to rock the boat. Few ever dared to speak out against the behemoth.
"And what form does this harm take?" Chumley said, pen poised above the signature part of the certificate. "Assassination?"
"I'm too valuable to assassinate," I told him. "They're more interested in attempting to access information by impersonation. There are people who might talk only to me about information that Goliath is after."
"They'd have to be good impersonators to fool people who know you well."
I thought for a moment. I wanted to aim for what Analogy had been given, and not for. Anything saner, and I was probably too normal. Anything more insane, and I'd be disqualified. I wondered what Phoebe Smalls had been given. She was utterly sane, but smart, too, so I'd have to assume that she knew the system as well as I did. She'd probably go for the same. It would be a delicate task, not merely to feign madness, but just the right level of madness. I leaned forward. "It's not the sort of impersonators you imagine. The Goliath Corporation has made considerable advances in the manufacture of Homo Syntheticus," I told him. And for a few years now, they've been manufacturing Thursdays who try to pass themselves off as me. 6 times that we know of.
Did you take these synthetics to the police?
The police are run by Goliath. I have a feeling we'd be wasting our time.
I see. And where are those synthetics now?
I stared at him thoughtfully. Although the Homo Syntheticus were wholly artificial, they appeared sentient. If they were shown to be legally equivalent to Neanderthals, we could be convicted of murder. If they were deemed illegally spliced chimeras, we were in no trouble at all, and could even claim a bounty by presenting an eyelid as proof. I decided to play it safe. I have no idea of their precise whereabouts. He stared at me for a moment, attempting to gauge if this idea could be real or was only a complex delusion.
Okay, he said, I'm going to make you a nut too. Generally sane. 7 Thursdays. Interesting.
It was a step in the right direction, but it wasn't enough. There weren't 7, I said quickly. There were 10.
10?
I counted them out on my fingers. 6 synthetics, 2 fictional Thursdays, me and my gran, who wasn't actually my gran, just a version of me that I thought was my gran, hiding in our present rather than hers. She had to spend the last 20 years of her life in Gingham and read the 10 most boring classics.
I'm sure there was a good reason.
Because she, I, changed the ending of Jane Eyre. It was an illegal narrative flexation. They would have liked to let me off, but the law is the law. Oh, perhaps I should have added that for much of my career I worked for Jurisfiction. It's a sort of policing agency in the book world, the realm that exists beyond the other side of the printed page.
You've been there?
Many times. I can read my way across, or at least I could before the accident. My mentor was Miss Havisham, who was terrific so long as you didn't mention the wedding. And Emperor Jacques, who is a barrel of laughs when he's not subjugating entire star systems in his tyrannical and inadequately explained quest for galactic domination.
Really?
Yes. Remember how 2 weeks went missing out of Samuel Pepys's diary a few years back? That was me having an off day. I continued in this vein for a while, outlining various adventures I'd had in the book world. I talked about the ongoing metaphor shortage, Speedy Muffler, the witheringly tiresome internal politics at the Council of Genres, about imagino-transference engines, Ultra Word, Commander Bradshaw's gorilla wife Melanie, and the first time I was attacked by Gramicides. I ended with an account of the reason for my current physical state during an assassination attempt in a quiet corner of the thriller genre, and how Red Herring had been responsible.
"Was Red Herring a red herring?" asked Chumley in some confusion.
"No," I replied reflectively, "but his name was. By calling Red Herring, it made people think that he couldn't be a red herring, as it was too obvious. So his name, Red Herring, then became the Red Herring when we found out he wasn't a red herring. Simple, yes?"
"No."
"I agree it's complicated," I said with a shrug. "Working in fiction does give one a somewhat tenuous hold on reality, but it's not the hold that's tenuous, it's the reality."
"Which reality? Whose reality? Does it matter anyway? And will there be cake?"
"And was there?"
"Was there what?"
"Cake." "Generally speaking, yes." Dr. Chumley rubbed his temples.
"I think I preferred Spike's sharpened spade earlier. At least that had a sort of uncomplicated creeping menace about it. The book world, it's all very confusing."
"I've spent most of my life confused," I replied. "You get used to it after a while. There's a lot to be said about merely having a hazy idea of what's going on, but generally reaching the right outcome by following broad policy outlines. In fact, I've a sneaky suspicion that it's the only way of getting things done. Once the horror and unpredictability of unintended consequences gets a hold, even the best-intentioned and noblest of plans generally descend to mayhem, confusion, and despair."
"I see," said Dr. Chumley, tearing off another certificate and scrunching it up. "I'm going to lower you to a nut 3, mildly aberrant behaviour with occasional long stretches of lucidity."
It still wasn't enough. "So the whole book world thing doesn't make me nuts?" I asked, semi-sarcastically.
"We do try to avoid that particular word when making a diagnosis in our profession," said Dr. Chumley with a sigh. "But sometimes I wonder if the human race isn't collectively as mad as a sack of doorknobs. Where does that put me in my profession? Trying to sort out the real nut jobs from the partial nut jobs, or just in a state of muddled damage limitation?" He took another deep breath and slumped face down on the table.
"Don't tell anyone I told you that. We're really just meant to nod and say things like, aha, and go on, and how does that make you feel?"
It would have helped me a lot more if Spike had told me he baked novelty cakes rather than killed the undead.
And no, it doesn't make you nuts, as you suggest. It might actually be true.
Damn. He partially believed me. "Before I worked here," he said with another sigh, "I would certainly have thought you dangerously delusional, but the SpecOps standards of reality are pretty broad. Here's an example. I had Captain Henshaw of the Odd Squad in here yesterday. But it wasn't our Captain Henshaw, it was Captain Henshaw F-76+, apparently on an important trade delegation from Reality F-76+, where everything is pretty much identical to here, only everyone has two heads."
"That's a bigger and more bizarre claim than the book world."
"Not really, because Henshaw F-76+ actually had two heads."
Did he argue with himself? I always wondered about that.
"Quite a lot, actually. That's why he came to see me. But there they were, two heads. So you see, what you say might actually be true. Might not be, but might. There you have it. Nut three."
It wasn't going well. I had to lose that extra ranking. Nut four or nothing. "I have something else I need to share," I said.
"Yes," replied Dr. Chumley, from where he was still resting face down on the table.
"Yes, I think I'm pregnant with an elephant."
"An elephant?" he asked, lifting his head from the table to stare at me.
"Yes, foisted on me by an over-amorous server at Greg's."
He shook his head sadly. "Now I know you're trying to pull a fast one. Everyone uses the pregnant with an elephant gambit to be downranked. I think Victor Analogy used it first."
He smiled triumphantly and pulled the pad of certificates toward him again.
"You're a nut three, my girl, and nothing you can say will change my mind."
"What about the fact that I think my mother was a snail named Andrew?"
"Nut three," he said firmly and continued to write.
"That I have a dodo named Pickwick, who is the oldest in existence?"
"Perfectly plausible," he replied.
"How about the fact that my son would have been given the job of ChronoGuard Director General due to his expert handling of asteroid HR-6984 that hasn't happened?"
Dr. Chumley looked up at me and smiled. "Listen," he said, "if you give me any more of that pretending to be mad act, I'll disregard all that book world stuff and you'll be upgraded back to a nut too." Blast. Foiled.
"Okay, then," I said, and sat quietly while Dr. Chumley filled out the form. I was just wondering, in vain, what else I could do to lessen the fact that I might not be mad enough to run SpecOps, when I noticed that the previous certificate had Commander Small's name on it, and by expertly reading upside down, a skill I'd advise for anyone working in a wheezing bureaucracy, I saw that she had indeed been listed as Nut 4. She must have thought up something really wacky. Smart, young, driven, insane. The SpecOps job was almost hers. I was just thinking about whether I could function under Smalls's leadership when Dr. Chumley stopped and stared at me.
"Why do you have Jenny is a mind worm written on the back of your hand?"
"I don't."
"You do?"
I looked down and he was right. There it was. I frowned for a moment as I tried to remember who had written it and when. I licked my fingers and rubbed pointlessly at the writing. It was a tattoo, but I couldn't remember getting it. I felt confused, angry, and my eyes moistened as I realized what was going on. The daughter Jenny, I remembered. The 12-year-old, with the infectious laugh and freckled nose, who had taken 22 hours of labour to push out. wasn't real at all. She didn't fall off a wall when she was 8 years old and didn't have nightmares about foxes in her bedroom. Never had, never would. As the realization dawned, I felt a sudden and overwhelming stab of grief, loss and bereavement that gave way to anger, then a sense of sad awareness that I went through this many times a day, and that Landon, the kids, and I had agreed that the tattoo was for the best. I knew, too, with a falling heart, that this moment of clarity would be fleeting, and my eyes filled with tears. Acheron Hades' little sister, I told him, as reason momentarily filtered into my head. She gave me a mind worm before going down for life. We're making inquiries at TJ Maxx as to what happened to her. We're hoping the tattoo will remind me often enough to break it. As it stands at the moment, I can forget I have the mind worm almost mid-sentence.
Does it affect your work?
Does what affect my work?
The mind worm.
What mind worm? I asked, unsure of whom he was referring to. Has Aornis been up to her tricks again?
You're joking, right? He asked.
What would I joke about? I asked, truthfully enough. You're here to rate me at Braxton's request. Hardly the time to piss about. Dr. Chumley took a deep breath, scrunched up the certificate for the third time, and started to fill it in again.
Nut four, he said resignedly.
I'm grateful, I said. But what made you change your mind?
Any more from you, my girl, he said through gritted teeth, and you'll be a nut five so fast it'll make your head spin.
Remember to remember me to your son, said Chazza, as I walked back through Dr. Chumley's waiting room. I haven't forgotten, I'm to remember, I said with a smile, and departed, clutching my prized Nut 4 certificate. I was now officially prone to strange and sustained delusional outbursts, but otherwise normal in all respects. And it felt good.